Our next speaker this morning is Dr. Roy Adams. Dr. Adams serves as the associate editor of the Adventist Review, our official church publication. Dr. Adams is no stranger to Andrews University. He obtained his Ph.D. degree here from Andrews. He's also a familiar author on a number of the subjects that Questions on Doctrine covers, including among his many works is the book The Sanctuary, published by the Review and Herald in 1994, and The Nature of Christ, also published by the Review in that same year. I remember Dr. Adams because I was an intern at the General Conference when I was in academy, and Dr. Adams was somebody I could always count on for a smile and a welcome greeting for a lowly intern walking the halls, and was always someone who would remember your name. So it's a privilege to have you here, and welcome to QOD.
The theology of questions on doctrine issues surrounding the nature of Christ and the atonement. We've been given a good handle on the history of questions and doctrine and all its background, and I was asked to deal with the theology, in particular the nature of Christ and the atonement. There is something about the history that is more interesting. It's like gossip, you know? You sit there on the edge of your seat listening to what happened, but theology is a little more boring. But nevertheless, that's my task this morning. I want to drop down to the fourth paragraph and begin there. I have divided this summary into four parts. First, QOD's position on the nature of Christ, its position on the atonement, the resulting reaction and controversy, and a brief assessment and critique. On the nature of Christ, and I'll be skipping as well in order to do this in the time allotted. QOD takes the position that while Jesus ever remained the blameless Son of God, his humanity was real and genuine. And by the way, I'm coming to this, I hope, without prejudice. I'm just looking at what's there. I'm trying to forget the history for a moment and just look to see what QOD is saying. He hungered and thirsted and was weary, etc. Drop a paragraph or two. All the while, however, Christ retained his divinity. And though coming in the likeness of sinful flesh, he, as the second Adam, did not possess a single taint of our sinful propensities and passions. Yes, there was laid on him the iniquity of us all. Yes, he bore our iniquities. And yes, God made him to be sin for us. But all this he bore vicariously, in the same way that he bore our griefs, carried our sorrows, took our infirmities, and endured our sicknesses. It could hardly be construed from these scriptures, says QOD, that Jesus was diseased or that he experienced the frailties to which our fallen human nature is heir. It is at this point, in its effort, as it were, to shield Jesus, that QOD steps on very precarious ground, a peril facing anyone, regardless of their particular view, who ventures onto this terrain. He did bear all this, QOD admits, and then goes on to put the following question. Could it not be that he bore this vicariously, just as he bore the sins of the whole world? These weaknesses, frailties, infirmities, failings, it says, are things which, with our own sinful fallen natures, we have to bear. To us, they are natural, inherent. And when he bore them not as something innately his, but he bore them as our substitute. He bore them in his perfect, sinless nature. The language is confusing, to be sure. In what sense can it be said that Jesus bore our weaknesses, frailties, and infirmities vicariously? Leaving alone what QOD calls his failings, one suspects that's a typo for feelings, how does one maintain that Jesus experienced the frailty of hunger vicariously? Is that to say that his hunger pangs were unreal? Did he not actually experience pain and fatigue? Was his feelings of sorrow not genuine? We see where QOD is heading with this when we understand that it all is a build-up to protecting the integrity of Christ's moral and spiritual nature. Christ bore all this vicariously, Quixote maintains, the earlier question mark now gone, just as vicariously he bore the iniquities of us all. Skip a few paragraphs. Quixote seems nervous where Ellen G. White isn't. Christ did not make believe take human nature, she says. He did verily take it. He did, in reality, possess human nature. White seems to feel no need to indulge in theological gymnastics with terms like vicarious or innate, but instead offers clear affirmations followed by equally clear-cut caveats. And those who accept the affirmations should be equally willing to allow the caveats. Her statements are cited on page 60 of QOD in part run as follows. He took the nature, but not the sinfulness of man. He took man's nature in its fallen condition, but did not in the least participate in its sin. He is a brother in our infirmities, but not in possessing like passions. In identifying himself with our needs, our weaknesses, and our feelings, he was a mighty petitioner, but not possessing the passions of our human fallen nature. We should have no misgivings in regard to the perfect sinlessness of the human nature of Christ. The Son of God became like one of us, except in sin. The difficulty and delicateness of the subject should steer us away from passing harsh judgments on those with varying views. But QOD's vicarious approach to the issue, to put it that way, is as confusing as it is unwarranted. Just one thing Ellen G. White wanted to make clear, and one thing only. We see it in the last statement above, quoted from the youth's instructor. She said, Jesus became like one of us, except in sin. In that single remark, this uneducated lady cuts to the chase and confounds a great deal of our heated debates, falling squarely in league with the best theology in Christendom. The sentiments are right out of the Creed of Chalcedon, so to speak, penned more than 1,400 years earlier. Quote, in all things like unto us, sin only excepted. And it leaves us free to say that Jesus took, actually took, our infirmities, our weaknesses, our nature, not vicariously, but for real. We can say all this without equivocation, so long as we understand that nothing he took amounted to sin, either experientially or inherently. And here I talk about this prolapsarian, prelapsarian, postlapsarian controversy, and I ask the question, where does QOD come down? And again, I come to it without prejudice. A few paragraphs down. One way to approach the question as to where QOD comes down is to observe which statement of Ellen G. White it selects is selected for display. On the one hand, one finds a group of Ellen G. White assertions that on their face seems to support a prelapsarian leaning. Notice, for example, the following. In each case, the emphasis is supplied. No one looking upon the childlike countenance shining with animation could say that Christ was like other children. He was God in human flesh. Christ vanquished Satan in the same nature over which in Eden Satan obtained the victory. And number four, Christ is called the second Adam, in purity and holiness, connected with God and beloved by God. He began where the first Adam began. Those sound very prelapsarian, but then there are these other statements. And I read only one on the next page, the last one. It is so strong. Number three, it would have been an almost infinite humiliation for the Son of God to take man's nature, even when Adam stood in his innocence in Eden. But Jesus accepted humanity when the race had been weakened by 4,000 years of sin. Like every child of Adam, he accepted the results of the working of the great law of heredity. In all fairness, we may conclude, on the basis of the Ellen G. White statements QOD selected for display, that the book stayed clear of adopting one side or the other in the prelapsarian, postlapsarian debate. This, I think, is an important point in view of the heatedness of the debate, decades-old controversy over this issue. I would skip the entire next passage. We have heard so much about it already, and I will be touching on the atonement just a little bit later. To save time, I will skip that passage. I'm so tempted to read it, but I know I would be out of time. So I go to the reaction and controversy. Every cause needs a champion, and it's probably safe to say that absent the agitation of M.L. Andreessen, questions on doctrine, for all the effort put into it, would have created hardly a stir in the Adventist Church. After all, upwards of 97% of the book, to use a purely arbitrary figure, constitutes basic Adventist teaching with wide acceptance within the Church. It was the vociferous objections of M.L. Andreessen on the disputed 3% that quickly eliminated the book's yawn factor, catapulting it to icon status, and ardent supporters on the one hand, and determined opponents on the other. Accordingly, I will focus here on Andreessen as the symbol of opposition to the document. Adventist evangelist Albion Fox Ballinger got into trouble with church leaders for, among other things, his attempt to make the sanctuary and other distinctly Adventist doctrines more evangelically friendly, more gospel-oriented. For his troubles, the well-meaning preacher was summoned before a special committee appointed to look into his theology. The trial was conducted in connection with the General Conference session in 1905 in Washington, D.C. Andreessen, only a young minister at the time, was not part of the trial committee, of course, but by his own account, he was able to eavesdrop on the pre-dawn proceedings undetected by standing on the shoulder of another young minister outside an open window in the trial room. Actually, they took turns standing on each other's shoulder. I point out in my dissertation, doctoral dissertation, that it is ironic that Andreessen, who traced his lifelong interest to the sanctuary atonement doctrine to that trial event, would himself come into conflict with church leaders 50 years later over some of the very issues for which Ballinger was tried, this time with the church championing key elements of Ballinger's 1905 position, namely the attempt to express Adventist doctrine in more evangelically friendly terms and the belief in a completed atonement of the cross. We may never know all the reasons, and we've been given many reasons here, but to understand why Andreessen was so angry, we have to understand his basic theological position. The areas of QOD he found most reprehensible centered around the nature of Christ and the atonement, two issues that for him lay at the very foundation of Adventist faith and identity. Not coincidentally, these two issues also happened to be closely related to a key theological concern Andreessen had nurtured all his life, namely the cosmic vindication of God through the absolute perfection of an eschatological remnant. And if anyone wants to quibble with the word absolute, I'm prepared to abandon it and get to the main point. The perfection of an eschatological remnant, a condition upon which the coming of Jesus depends. For Andreessen, the cleansing of the sanctuary involved the purification of that final remnant, and their achievement of sinless perfection would spell the experiential culmination of the atonement. It's against this background that we can appreciate the strength of his reaction to any notion of a completed, let alone final, atonement at the cross. For him, the rapprochement with the evangelicals constituted a sinister attempt on the part of highly placed Adventist officials to compromise the very essence of Adventism, the atonement. Andreessen divided the atonement, as we've heard umpteen times, into three parts, of which only the second involved Christ's suffering on the cross. In the first, comprising his earthly life and ministry, Christ demonstrates that sin could be completely resisted and overcome, that complete victory is possible. The third phase of the atonement occurring in the heavenly sanctuary, or in the third phase, Christ, it involves the purification and cleansing of the remnant, Christ demonstrating in their lives that his victory over sin was not unique, but is repeatable in them. Drop a paragraph. Against that background, Andreessen considered key QOD statements on the nature of Christ to be utterly reckless and irresponsible. As regards the nature of Christ during the incarnation, for example, Barnhaus, a participant in the dialogue, had reported that Adventist leaders had affirmed that it was sinless, holy, perfect, and that any other position was completely repugnant to them. Andreessen was deeply, deeply offended. As he understood it, Christ, in his incarnation, took upon himself sinful human nature. He was not, as QOD had affirmed, exempt. Another paragraph down. If the notion that Christ was exempt from inherited passions and pollutions destroyed the first phase of the atonement, the idea that the atonement of the cross was final or even complete destroyed the third phase, that transpiring in the most holy place. For as Andreessen saw it, that last phase of the atonement, a distinctly Adventist teaching, is critical and cannot be jettisoned from Adventist theology without severe damage. For it's during this phase that Christ would fulfill his promise to make us overcomers. The work of atonement cannot be finished without that final demonstration of perfection in the 144,000, the crown and pride of the finished mediatorial work of Christ. Andreessen was shocked to see the Church of the Living God commissioned to carry the gospel of the final to the final generation, begging for entrance into the evangelical fold. This is more than apostasy, he said. It is giving up Adventism, the rape of a whole people, a treasonous denial of God's leading in the past. It is the omega of apostasy. I come now to the assessment and critique. Perhaps it was inevitable that QOD and its participants engaged in as wide-ranging a project as these conversations turn out to be, would at some point commit a blunder or two, unintentional or not. I've noted three such instances. I may not mention the three, but the first faux pas had to do with the expression lunatic fringe, and you've heard enough about that by this time. And the second one had to do with this, with the heading, that famous or infamous subheading in QOD, took sinless nature. Ironically, Ellen G. White herself never puts the three words sinless human nature together in any reference I could find. Indeed, among the citations collected under the heading in question is one statement in which she avers that Christ took upon himself man's nature in its fallen condition. It would be rather difficult to make the case that taking man's nature in its fallen condition is equal to taking sinless nature. Incidentally, and this is also significant, neither did Ellen G. White ever use the expression sinful human nature. Let me just rephrase that. In any statement I could find in reference to Christ, a term Andreessen hurled against the QOD participants. The nature Jesus took. The following statement from QOD gave Andreessen considerable grief. Speaking about Jesus, it says, he could rightly be chosen, and these are QOD's words, he could rightly be chosen, I mean, QOD is quoting, of course, that's not Ellen G. White. He could rightly be chosen out of the people because he was holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners. He came into humanity not by natural generation, but by a miracle. His birth was supernatural. God was his father. Although born in the flesh, he was nevertheless God and was exempt from the inherited passions and pollutions that corrupt the natural descendants of Adam. There was nothing in him that responded to the evil one. Andreessen was aghast. Now, of course, both QOD and Andreessen, let me digress for a while, both QOD and Andreessen would claim Ellen G. White for support. But going to the paragraph next, what I've noticed vis-a-vis Ellen G. White's nature of Christ statements is precisely what gave Andreessen difficulty in regard to her atonement ones. apparent discrepancy, quote unquote, was the expression Andreessen used to characterize her atonement statements. Regarding Christ's nature, she could say on the one hand that the divinity of Christ is the believer's assurance of eternal life, and on the other, that the humanity of the Son of God is everything to us, the golden chain that binds our souls to Christ and through Christ to God. Thus she gives equal weight to both aspects. Throughout her writings, we see this balance. Some statements seem to give the impression that Christ is all like us. Others emphasize the wide difference. Whereas QOD was at pains to affirm that Christ took our weaknesses and infirmities vicariously, she saw the situation otherwise. In one extraordinary statement, she mentions that Jesus might have helped his human nature to withstand the inroads of disease by pouring from his divine nature vitality and undecaying vigor to the human nature. But he humbled himself to man's nature. What humility is this? In the middle of the next paragraph, or toward the middle, or toward the end, I say this indicates that Christ was vulnerable to physical human weaknesses and disease. That's what she is saying. As quoted in QOD, she makes it clear, however, that Christ was born without a taint of sin. There'd be no point to make such a remark except to distinguish his birth from that of all other humans since the fall. She makes that crystal clear when after describing the deep-rooted, deadly leprosy of sin that has infected all of us, she says, but Jesus, coming to dwell in humanity, receives no pollution. No one, including those with a prophetic gift, speaks with the same tightness of language at all times and under all circumstances. So long as we perceive no misunderstanding of our words, we are content to carry on without taking any special precaution. But the moment someone expresses puzzlement about what they think they're hearing from us, we tighten our language to prevent any further interpretation. That's undoubtedly what we see in her response to an Adventist brother on one occasion. It's her most careful and definitive statement on the issue in question. It's not watertight, but it's a very careful statement. Anchoring her remarks on Luke 1:31-35, among other scriptures, she wrote as follows, and I would not read it, you've heard it a million times. Be careful, exceedingly careful, how you dwell upon the human nature of Christ. Do not set him before the people as a man with the propensities of sin. He is the second Adam. The first Adam was created a pure, sinless being without a taint of sin upon him. He was in the image of God. He could fall, and he did fall through transgressing. Because of sin, his posterity was born with inherent propensities of disobedience. But Jesus was the only begotten Son of God. He took upon himself human nature and was tempted in all points as human nature is tempted. He could have sinned. He could have fallen. But not for one moment was there in him an evil propensity. Drop down toward the end of the quote. The incarnation of Christ has ever been and will ever remain a mystery. That which is revealed is for us and for our children. But let every human being be warned from the ground of making Christ altogether human, such an one as we, as ourselves, for it cannot be. In regard to handling the atonement, I would also leave aside that paragraph where L.E. Froom let slip that word final. We have discussed it quite a lot here. But at the top of the next page, there were certain aspects of QOD's, the development of the subject of the atonement, that seemed a tad problematic to me. In one place, for example, almost trying to prove too much, QOD launches into a discussion of the semantic range of kafar, a gratuitous exercise that led to what it saw as examples of atonement without blood sacrifice. Seizing upon such sentiments, its critics quickly accused it of advocating bloodless atonement, a controversy that led to the spilling of much needless ink and emotion. In a similar vein, QOD came up with examples of atonement that can leave some squirming. He used the vicious killing of Saul's descendants in reparation for Saul's earlier slaughter of the Gibeonites as a good example of atonement is both puzzling and problematic. And to suggest that the violent action of Phinehas, however important in the history of Israel, is somehow illustrative of the work of Jesus engenders unnecessary and uncomfortable questions. QOD might have done better to cite such examples, if it had to, as distant semantic cousins of the atonement concept and not as illustrative of God's saving work in Jesus. Moreover, one gets the impression that the evangelicals could hardly have been interested in such obtuse details. Such departures notwithstanding, it seems clear that QOD consistently, and again without prejudice, held to both complete atonement at the cross and a continuing atonement through Christ's ministry in the heavenly sanctuary. And in respect to that, it seemed to have, in respect of the second point, the first point, the atonement of the cross, it seemed to have the heavy backing of Ellen G. White. As I say in the quotations that follow, I read two of them. Number two says, when he offered himself on the cross, a perfect atonement was made for the sins of the people. And the next one, he planted the cross between heaven and earth, and when the Father beheld the sacrifice of his Son, he bowed before it in recognition of its perfection. It is enough, he said. The atonement is complete. Puzzled by such E.G. White affirmations of a completed atonement on the cross, Andreessen tells how shortly after Ballinger's 1905 trial, he personally visited Ellen G. White's home in St. Helena, that should be St. Helena, California, spending fully 3 months researching the original manuscripts of her published works. And this is a quotation from him. This apparent discrepancy was one of the problems I wanted to have clarified. According to him, he found 7 statements that the atonement was made on the cross and 22 statements that the final atonement was made in heaven. The lesson he drew from all this was that quote, I may not accept one set of statements and reject the other if I wish to arrive at truth. But no one listening to the vehemence of Andreessen's opposition to QOD on that very point would ever suspect that he had once come to terms with it. In fact, in one of his most extraordinary statements on the subject, he seems to belittle the cross, and I say this with respect. The last part of that sentence on the page beginning, dreadful as were the sufferings on the cross, they did not begin to compare with the sufferings of God from the time sin first entered heaven. Drop down a little in the quote. In another place, Andreessen contended that our salvation, quote, our salvation was not accomplished by a few hours of suffering, dreadful as they were. And then he makes this truly startling statement, quote, let not the cross hide from us the deeper aspects of the atonement. The danger of an unguarded theology is clear. The final generation concept, Andreessen's stridency on the issue of the nature of Christ and the atonement had to do, as noted above, with the perfecting of the final generation of Christians, the 144,000. And no one with a sense of the growing worldliness and secularism in some sectors of the church today would poo-poo the quest for righteousness and holiness, the fervent desire to become like Jesus. It's a matter of utmost importance and urgency. But we need always to keep our theological wits about us. What are the dimensions of holiness? What does it involve? If we see holiness solely in the context of isolationist pietism, then we proceed in a certain direction with its own requirements, stipulations, and emphases. However, if we understand holiness in a broader sense, a sense that includes our life and service in community with others, as well as a radical commitment to God in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, then we will tend to go in the direction described In the words of the ancient prophet, he has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does God require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Micah's is a brand of holiness anchored in kindness, in justice, in humility. Three qualities that characterize the life and ministry of Jesus and which he enunciated in his inaugural message at a Nazareth synagogue following his temptation, a message anchored in the book of Isaiah, Micah's contemporary. It's a holiness with an eye for justice, with a concern for the poor, the oppressed, the marginalized. It's holiness with a sensitivity to ethics and equity. Without these ingredients, our holiness becomes repulsive in the eyes of God. His admonition to his people, as we find it in Amos, is that we let justice roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. And in the words of Ellen G. White, unless there is practical self-sacrifice for the good of others, in the family circle, in the neighborhood, in the church, and wherever we may be, then whatever our profession, we are not Christians. I'm coming to the end now, and I just wanted to say, just as an aside, that I like to keep things simple. I remember when we lived in the Philippines, our children were about 7 and 5, and they're playing with their crayons on the floor one day, and my boy suddenly says, "Daddy, will there be stars in heaven?" And then I began scratching my head to get a theological answer from the seminary to the question. My little girl, also playing on the floor, said, "Of course not. There'd be no night there." And I said, "Okay." And he was satisfied. And I had to give no answer to the question. And it taught me a lesson to keep theology simple. And so I want to just end simply for all I've been saying so far. It's important that we get our theology right. Defective theology is not a victimless enterprise. What we believe affects our children, other members of our immediate family, and the wider community, but particularly our children. To place before them unrealistic and unbiblical standards and goals can discourage them, negatively radicalize them, and even destabilize them psychologically. To bend theology to fit our eschatological goals and objectives is neither sound nor prudent. We do not cut Jesus down to our own size for the purpose of using him as example. That approach is as unproductive as it is unwarranted. He is our example, whether we wish it or not, our supreme example. But much as we need an example, we needed a savior more. And to have a savior, we must maintain with Ellen G. White and the best theology in Christendom that he is in all things like unto us, sin only, experientially and inherently accepted. Our continuance as an authentic Christian communion could hang on just this one point.